While homeowners know Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as the big dogs of the mortgage business, Washington knows them as big players in lobbying. The two corporations staved off government regulations for years, and they did it by lobbying hard and spending generously. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
Between the two of them, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have spent about $3.5 million on lobbying and hired 42 outside firms. That would be just for the first 3 months of this year. Take that kind of clout, then add Fannie and Freddie's huge mortgage portfolios reaching into every corner of the country, and it's easy to see why the companies have never lacked for confidence on Capitol Hill. For example, from February, Fannie Mae CEO Daniel Mudd testifying to the Senate Banking Committee. Given the housing crisis, Mudd said, there should be some flexibility in regulation. He warned against what he called arbitrary limits.
Yes, indeed, these are tough times. And that is when you want a Fannie Mae around.
In fact, Fannie and Freddie have made it a point always to be around Capitol Hill and around the rest of official Washington, too. Former Congressman Jim Leach is an Iowa Republican and an old nemesis of Fannie and Freddie. In Congress, he helped lead the push to rein them in.
Well, there have been a lot of rhetorical efforts to tighten regulation, but Fannie and Freddie have both done a pretty deft job of fending that off.
Besides calling it deft, Leach also calls it muscular. Fannie and Freddie have kept their profiles high because of their odd situation. They're not government agencies, but they're not regular corporations either. As government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, they're often thought to have guarantees of federal support. It lets them get discounts when they borrow money. To maintain that advantage and others, they hire well-placed politicos at big salaries. A rival lobbyist once described Fannie Mae as a political organization that happened to be in the mortgage business. Past executives of Fannie Mae include Democratic operatives and appointees. Former CEO Jim Johnson made news last month when questions about his personal finances forced him out as chief of Barack Obama's vice presidential search team. It's similar over at Freddie Mac. Former Republican Congresswoman Susan Molinari is a contract lobbyist. Democratic operative Harold Ickes used to be on the board. And the two GSEs are famous for campaign contributions, money going in all directions to both parties. Jim Leach, now head of the Kennedy School's Institute of Politics and chairman of the watchdog group Common Cause, says he finds that especially troubling.
They have done an awful lot in terms of the money game that causes the kinds of conflicts of interest that bedevil the American political system.
In the 2006 campaign, Fannie gave almost $1 million, Freddie over $600,000. In that same election cycle, the nation's biggest lender, Countrywide, gave barely $250,000. And the GSEs raised money from others. 5 years ago, a Freddie Mac document described an 18-month push by the company's lobbyists. They held more than 75 fundraising events for members of just one House committee, the one that oversees Freddie and Fannie. Freddie Mac later paid the Federal Election Commission a record-setting fine of $3.8 million. But now the housing crisis has overtaken the old realities. Mike House is director of FM Policy Focus, a lobbying group that's campaigned for years to regulate the GSEs more strictly. Even now, House isn't ready to say their influence on Capitol Hill will diminish.
They'll have clout because of the role they have. Whether it's more or less, we'll just have to see.
The GSEs are waiting to see as well. Spokesman at Freddie Mac didn't return messages yesterday, and executives at Fannie Mae weren't talking. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
To see a list of politicians who once worked for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, go to NPR.org. Here's a new checklist for you. Recycle, yeah. Drive a Prius, check. Love life, not so great. Some environmentalists are having a tough time finding true love. NPR's Ben Bergman sat in on a gathering of singles in Santa Monica, California that organizers dubbed a green speed dating event.
You know, it's hard enough finding singles in L.A. with dashing good looks, a witty sense of humor, and a steady job. Tonight, there is another challenge. They've also got to have a low carbon footprint. Even environmentalists have their limits, though, so everyone valet parks. This is L.A. after all. And what do these tree huggers drive?
I drive an SUV.
An SUV?
I have a Land Rover. A Range Rover.
Jeff Sabrucher is a hedge fund manager who lives in downtown L.A. He says he's been trying really hard to get rid of his gas guzzler.
Do you consider yourself green?
Well, I recycle. That's pretty much what I do, actually. I recycle, and I try to donate money to causes, green causes.
Sabrucha is one of about 16 singles here, mostly in their 30s and 40s. They have mere minutes to see if the sparks fly before organizer Vince Dell sounds his horn, and daters make the choice.
If you like somebody, pick yes in the match form. If you don't like them, pick no, but not in front of their face, okay?
No awkward exchange of numbers, no stinging face-to-face rejections.
At the end of the event, sometime tonight, I'll give you your mutual matches. So if you both pick yes, you'll get an email saying so-and-so likes you.
Dell says the key to effective speed dating is to say as little as possible.
For guys, don't talk too much. The more you say it, the more ammunition women have to reject you.
You want to leave them wanting more.
Exactly. Be mysterious, that way you get a second date.
A few minutes may not seem like much, but actually Dell says in speed dating, time is the enemy.
We ask every person at these events how much time they need. Guys need about 5 seconds, women need about 10. And so 3 minutes is more than enough. But the 3 minutes will kill you, though. They might like you after the first 5 seconds, but 2 minutes later that you're gone.
Hoping to avoid that fate, Jeff Sabrucho sits down at a small table across from Felicia Williams. Their date begins like all do, with awkward small talk.
Where are you from, Felicia?
So I live in Pasadena.
Okay. There's a lot of Pasadena people here for some
really?
Reason. Yeah, there's like 3 of them already so far.
Oh, I didn't know. We should have carpooled.
Luckily, the horn sounds before the Prius-driving Williams has a chance to ask Sabrucha what he drives.
Okay, nice meeting you too. What's your name again?
Jeff,
okay.
Maybe Williams will have more luck with the next guy, aerospace consultant Francois Jacquet.
I'm very green.
Jacquet is so green that he does something even better than drive a hybrid.
You know why? I don't own a car. I ride a bicycle. I walk all the time. Whenever I absolutely need a car, make a list of things I need to do, I rent one. I feel that this is pretty green, okay?
Okay, at the end of the night, everyone turns in their match forms. Everyone except Jacquet, that is, because unfortunately, no one is green enough for him.
Let's say somebody does all their shopping at Whole Foods Network. They drive a Prius and throughout all their working incandescent lights. All those efforts are misguided, but at least they tried, you know? I didn't even see anybody like that here. I mean, we can't all drive a bicycle like I do, but I want to see people at a green speed dating event that have at least tried, done something. But hey, let's have more of these. I think they're great.
Plans are already in the works for more green speed dating, this time in Orange County, California. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
And now let's go to another community where one wealthy family is creating jobs. It's in Venezuela, which has suffered its share of political turmoil. The president, Hugo Chavez, uses revolutionary rhetoric that has incited poor squatters to invade large farms. Chavez says rich landowners care little about the poor. But one of those landowners, whose land was invaded, has welcomed the squatters. His name is Alberto Vollmer. He's providing his polarized country with a lesson in how to get along. NPR's Juan Ferreira reports from Venezuela's Hacienda Santa Teresa.
A tour guide welcomes people to the 212-year-old hacienda, about an hour's drive outside of Caracas. The sun is shining on row upon row of sugarcane. The smell of molasses is in the air, and tourists are drinking as they tour Santa Teresa, famous for producing some of Latin America's best rum. On this day, the tourists include a group of senior citizens, among them, Hermenia Gavidia. She gushes about the rum, and after a taste testing, jokes that what she needs is a bed. But Santa Teresa is also celebrated as the testing ground for an unusual social experiment. It's an experiment that's won renown for Alberto Vollmer, Santa Teresa's president, and also brought social peace. That's permitted Santa Teresa to thrive like never before. Its vast distillery, as the tour guide explains, turning cane into rum that's exported to 27 countries. The Vollmer family's foray into social work might seem incompatible with their patrician roots. They're among Venezuela's wealthiest, and Santa Teresa has been in the family's hands since 1885. But when dozens of families invaded in 2000, just a year after Chavez took office, Vollmer didn't fight back. He instead offered land and home building expertise, working with squatters and government officials to create a community for landless people.
We said this isn't just going to be a piece of land where you're going to build improvised housings. We're going to design what the houses are going to look like.
The neighborhood carved out of the hacienda now features 100 sturdy homes. In exchange, the owners agreed to pay state-sponsored mortgages and make sure their kids went to school. Jumila Aquino is among the proud homeowners.
Thank God we have a dignified home that I can use for my children. It's big. It has 2 bedrooms, a bathroom, living room, kitchen, and a really big patio. It seems like somebody else's house. That's my house.
Vollmer's willingness to work with the squatters irritated some elites, but it won him kudos from a government that's usually hostile to the wealthy. 3 years later, something else happened that led Vollmer on yet another crusade.
We were mugged.
Gang members had stolen a security officer's gun. Vollmer directed his guards to capture the young delinquents. Then he made them an offer they couldn't refuse. Either work for free on his hacienda for 3 months and accept psychological help and job training, or be turned over to the local police. The gang members went for Vollmer's first offer.
So I thought, wow, this is a huge opportunity. You know, they've given us the most important thing they have, which is their identity. So let's go ahead with this. Let's see what we can do.
Soon, other gang members wanted in. That gave Vollmer another idea.
Dale, va. Oi!
He told them they had to play rugby. It's not popular in baseball-crazed Venezuela, but Vollmer's fanatical about the sport. He says it teaches discipline and teamwork. The former gang members come from barrios like the one just up the hill from Santa Teresa. Music blares from boomboxes, and teenagers huddle on corners. Jose Arrieta is a former gang member and one of the first to join Vollmer's program. He now works in Santa Teresa.
It's rare to find someone who believes in you. And when that happens, you feel proud that someone so important and interesting shows confidence. And that's what drives you to do things the way they should be done.
Program members continue living in barrios, where violence has claimed the lives of 5 in recent months. And others have dropped out. But dozens have graduated to a law-abiding life. Vollmer said a key to success has been ensuring the young men play a lead role in improving their own lives.
It's not a handout, it's thinking of something sustainable, and it's actually bringing them up to much better standards that are much better for them.
Vollmer says the lesson he's learned is simple. If you negotiate, he says, your enemy can become your friend. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Hacienda Santa Teresa, Venezuela.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The year's highest-grossing concert tour ends this evening at Madison Square Garden. Tonight's show caps a remarkable return to the top for Bon Jovi. Yes, that Bon Jovi. The band responsible for such 80s pop metal anthems as Living on a Prayer and You Give Love a Bad Name. Bon Jovi has reinvented itself by turning to a new market, country music. NBR's Nate DeMeo reports on the secret of Bon Jovi's new success and what it says about changes in the music industry over the band's 25-year career.
It's 1983. John Bon Jovi is 21. He's already spent years toiling in a dying New Jersey music scene, fronting bar bands and playing high schools and vets halls. He's got a demo, but no one cares. Times are tough, but he's got dreams. It's like a Bon Jovi song.
I went to a radio station.
WAPP, the Apple, in the appropriately named Success New York.
This station in particular was so new that it didn't even have a receptionist yet. And that was beneficial because I got to knock on the DJ's booth. And on a commercial break, he came out And we made some small talk, and he took the tape and he listened to it. On the street where you live, girls talk about their social lives. They made a lipstick plastic and paint. Such a shame when you rise.
The song was Runaway. Soon it was in heavy rotation. And hardworking Jon Bon Jovi from New Jersey was on his way to mega mid-80s success. His music had the big guitar hooks that rock radio loved. He had the big smile that teenage girls loved. And he had the big hair that, perhaps inexplicably, much of America loved.
That's what every kid in the mall looked like in 1986. You know, Bono had the same haircut. Like it or not, that was the truth.
But Bon Jovi says that a lot of what got his band tagged with that pejorative hair metal label, along with bands like Def Leppard and Whitesnake and Warrant and Rat, stopped with the Aquanet hairspray. He says that something that was distinctly Bon Jovi emerged on their 1986 album, Slippery When Wet.
But we stumbled upon something that created a sound. You know, you compounded the big rock chorus or the pop sensibility of that chorus, catchy sing-along kind of lyric with a story, and then the folks in the audience became Tommy and Gina.
Tommy, the kid who used to work on the dock with his six-string and hawk, and Gina, his girl from the diner, in the song called Living on a Prayer. Its huge Raise Your Lighters chorus helped define what Jon Bon Jovi wanted his songs to be about.
Tales of optimism and hope and those universal messages that are both timeless and classic have resonated with generations.
At that time, radio seemed to be filled with songs of struggle and striving in the white working class. Springsteen, John Mellencamp, even Journey and Poison had them. Bon Jovi's optimistic anthems virtually ruled the charts for several years there. But then a Nirvana song came and changed things. Grunge, with its more internal, intimate themes, swept out the bombastic pop metal sound. Jon Bon Jovi says that suddenly a lot of bands were falling all over themselves, trying to fake their way into the new trend, but not his.
Oh, it was a very conscious decision to not pretend to be something you were not.
And they didn't. And they couldn't very well pretend to be a boy band or do a hip-hop crossover either. And their fans rewarded them for it. And they were still selling millions of albums. Mitchell Peters writes for Billboard magazine. He says that the types of working-class anthems that defined the 80s were still around. They just weren't on pop radio anymore.
Country fans are sort of a dedicated, hardcore fan base. This sort of relates to who their fans are, you know, the sort of middle America working class. And so it seemed like a natural fit to sort of try and tap into that fan base.
2 years ago, Bon Jovi had its first hit on the country charts, a duet with Jennifer Nettles from the band Sugarland. They followed it up last year with an album called Lost Highway, recorded in Nashville. Saving times, spending too much time on the telephone. He says you can't go. Country stars like Keith Urban and Kenny Chesney already sounded a lot like Bon Jovi. John Rich is half of the band Big and Rich, who joined Bon Jovi on a big, working-for-the-weekend stomper called We Got It Going On.
I think Bon Jovi is a great American musical act. They obviously are known for being a rock band, but I think as they have gotten up into their 40s and have gotten married and had kids, they have a different perspective on life, and they apply their energy towards a little bit different version of what they're known for, which is straight ahead hard rock and roll, they become country.
He points out that several songs in the current country top 40 are from pop and rock artists who've crossed over, like Jessica Simpson and the Eagles, and that one guy from Hootie and the Blowfish. For his part, Jon Bon Jovi says that he's made a slightly twanged up Jon Bon Jovi record. He says he'll always be that guy from New Jersey, writing about Tommy from the docks and Gina from the diner, whomever they might be now in 2008.
When you sing a song like Living on a Prayer 21 years later, it marks memories in people's lives that come to see you. They think about where they were the first time they heard it, or that first kiss, or they got married to it, or they played it for their kids now that they're old enough. You see in the eyes of the public that are singing them back to you at the top of their lungs in those stadiums, you know that you touched somebody, and they in turn touched you.
Next year, Bon Jovi will be eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He admits that he'd like to get in, but he knows he's never been a critic's favorite. But 25 years into it, he's still selling records. He's never been a nostalgia act. And he's got the biggest tour of the year. He'd like to think he has a shot. Nate DiMeo, NPR News.
You can hear songs from Bon Jovi's latest album, Lost Highway, at the music section of our website. That's npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Now, the end of a gold rush. Not for nuggets of the precious metal, but for golden kernels of corn that can be brewed and distilled into ethanol. It took off in 2006 in response to two federal policies. One policy was long-standing. Most gasoline had to include some additive that would oxygenate it, make it burn cleaner, and reduce air pollution. The other policy was new. The government decided not to indemnify the oil companies against lawsuits over the additive that they had been using, methyl tertiary butyl ether, or MTBE. So there had to be an additive, it couldn't be the old one, and there was ethanol, alcohol distilled from corn, and for using it, the oil companies could get a 51-cent a gallon tax credit. The rush was on.
Wisconsin's largest ethanol plant is set to go online.
On the outskirts of Jefferson, in the middle of a cornfield, a rebirth is taking place.
More recently, the news from the Corn Belt about ethanol has been a lot less upbeat.
This is where construction should be taking place to build a new ethanol plant near Wahoo. But right now, there are only a few pieces of equipment and a lot of dirt. And it may look like this for some time.
What happened? I asked Chris Hurt, who's a professor of agricultural economics in the heart of the Corn Belt at Purdue University in Indiana.
The ethanol industry is going through some, I think, adjustments, or we might say growing pains. Obviously, we've seen a massive boom in ethanol. We've seen a lot of capacity put in place. We've had some infrastructure problems in terms of moving all of that ethanol. And we've seen some very rapid changes in prices. One of those changes is the price of the raw material here in the Midwest. That's corn.
You mean the corn is much more expensive now for the ethanol plant to buy than it was perhaps when they started building that ethanol plant?
That's right. When we go back and look at the 8 years from 1998 through 2005 crops, U.S. farmers received just a little bit over $2 a bushel for their corn. We were in largely a surplus corn production situation. Today, we've seen corn go to $6, and then with the flooding most recently through the Midwest, above $7 a bushel.
So if I'm an ethanol plant, I've got to buy corn at that very expensive price.
That's exactly right. We have seen what was very profitable ethanol margins 2 years ago when many of these plants were being built, and in fact so profitable with $2 corn that an ethanol plant could be paid off, totally paid off, in 6 months.
That might have been the case in 2006, but typically that would not be the forecasted return.
Not in 2008. That's Mark Stowers of Poet, one of the biggest ethanol companies. He insists that while the gold rush may be finished, Poet is not.
There's already evidence that some people have closed plants and some people have not started up plants. I don't see that impacting Poet. We have three plants that will open up in the late third quarter, fourth quarter of this year.
And on schedule. They will open up on schedule.
We fully expect that. There's no reason to believe otherwise.
But Poet did have to cancel plans for a plant in Minnesota this year for lack of an air quality permit. That's one of 18 problem plants that you can read about on a map online at the website earth2tech.com. The map is called the Biofuels Death Watch. That's because so many ethanol plants are either late to open, soon to close, or already out of business. And there are the plants that are just barely making it.
I'll tell you, we're on the edge right now. We are one bad day of ethanol pricing away from having to decide to shut the plant down.
That's Ken DeCubellis, the CEO of Ultra Biofuels, a California-based ethanol company. In April, Ultra opened a $170 million plant in Cloverdale, Indiana. Trucks drive in and dump their loads of corn to be distilled into alcohol and then shipped off to be blended into auto fuel. The Cloverdale plant is powered by natural gas, and it employs all of 47 people. Two giant storage tanks hold as much as 500,000 bushels each of dried corn, ready to be processed. A few years ago, filling them both with corn that cost $2 a bushel would have been easy. But today, Ken DeCubellis says, Ultra has to watch its costs very carefully.
We run lean and mean. With corn at $7 a bushel, you don't have the working capital to fill these things up, right?
DeCubellis is an engineer MBA who used to work for ExxonMobil. Having made the switch to biofuels, he is a gung-ho proponent of ethanol, but he's also realistic about the business and the impact of rising prices on his inputs.
If we aren't able to cover our variable costs, which are obviously the corn and the nat gas and the chemicals and enzymes that we consume, we will not run the plant.
That's an extraordinary statement you've made, that one day of bad ethanol prices and you could be led to shut down here. You've got a very valuable liquid in there, and one day the price could go down. It's that close?
It's like I said, Robert. We are barely covering our costs today. We're not servicing our debt at these prices, but we're barely covering our costs. I'm aware of other plants that have already shut down. Verisun, who's the largest producer in the industry, has recently announced that they are not starting up three of their huge projects that were slated to come online within the next 30 days. Okay, that's a statement right there that this industry is on the edge.
Purdue economist Chris Hertz says two big changes explain what's happened to the ethanol producers.
Number one, the price of ethanol. We've produced enough, we can oxygenate the gasoline, so it now is just a substitute for gasoline, the BTUs.
In other words, once the federal requirement for a clean additive has been met, ethanol is only worth as much as the energy it packs, plus the tax break it conveys. And in fact, ethanol packs less energy than gasoline. So ethanol can't sell for as much as gasoline, but it has to sell for more than corn. Chris Hurt has plotted corn prices and ethanol prices for the past year, and his graph, you can see it at npr.org, shows what ethanol makers know all too well. Profit margins have been mostly slim and sometimes negative. The second big change, Chris Hurt says, has to do with what used to be seen as the perennial problem facing the Corn Belt, the threat of producing too much corn.
That concept that corn was unlimited, we just have a surplus of corn, we just need to get rid of it somehow, corn is not unlimited. If we used every bushel of corn that we produced this year, we could only substitute for about 14% to 15% of the gasoline.
In fact, according to the most recent figures, more than 30% of the 2008 U.S. corn crop is going to ethanol, and it accounts for about 8% of all the blended gasoline sold at the pump.
Some of the literary tradition of New Orleans seems to have survived Hurricane Katrina. That's the impression you get when you hear from the author Julie Smith. She's written more than a dozen murder mysteries set in the city, and they give you a look at the secrets of a city where nothing is ever quite what it seems. NPR's J.J. Sutherland reports.
There's a door. A shirtless drunk is passed out in front of it. Then a bar. Then another door. Doesn't look promising. The stairwell is even less promising. Dark, decrepit. Then, on the third floor, a door opens into a space seemingly the size of a bowling alley. An assault of color leaps off the walls, oranges and blues and greens. Pillars are painted in fantastic designs. The chandeliers are draped, no, covered, with gold Mardi Gras beads. The far wall, could be 100 feet away, is lined with books. Mysteries, mostly. Many of them written by the woman whose home this is, Julie Smith.
They say that New Orleans must be a great place to write mysteries because there's so much crime there. And I always sort of have to laugh and say, oh yeah, that's just great. But of course, that has nothing to do with it. It's all about the secrets.
Julie Smith's New Orleans is full of secrets. The most famous detective she's invented, Skip Langdon of New Orleans Police Homicide, makes a living out of exposing those secrets. Skip is a tall, large woman who feels slightly out of place in her own body in her home of New Orleans. Smith says she represents her adolescent self, although they both obviously love the city they live in spite of its flaws. Here she is reading from her novel, House of Blues.
Yet despite crime and corruption, New Orleans remains arguably the most beautiful American city, the most gracious, the most charming. It is also the most eccentric. Walker Percy, one of its most revered writers, noted that here, the tourist is apt to see more nuns and naked women than he ever saw before, the combination being the intriguing part.
Smith says that everyone is welcome in New Orleans as long as they're not boring. On a hot, sticky day in July, Smith sits her hat on her head and ventures out into the city she loves and the secrets it hides, and how those secrets are inevitably revealed in a place where everyone seems to know everyone.
It is a city and a village at the same time. It's like there are only half a dozen people living here. Nobody has any secrets from anybody. Although they do. It's just that eventually everybody finds them out.
The drive uptown isn't long, but it is a world away. Graceful mansions, looking as if they're showing off to each other, line the streets of the Garden District. It was here that the Americans who came to the city hundreds of years ago built to impress the French locals. Didn't work. But their vanity has left a beautiful stain on the land. Smith walks up to one house which is in every guidebook. It is a sonnet written in balconies and iron lace. Surrounding its gardens is a fence made to look like cornstalks, leaves wrapping their way up, the finials bunches of metal-ripe corn that look almost good enough to eat. Julie Smith studies the mansion, which in one of her novels housed a large southern Gothic family, a corrupt judge, and of course, a murder.
Look how huge it is. Is that beautiful? But you can imagine lots of old family secrets occurring there, can't you? All kinds of stuff.
Only a short ferry ride away is a place very few tourists ever go, Algiers Point. It's a quiet neighborhood, says Smith. Affordable houses, not much crime, a good place to raise a family. But that's not quite what she has in mind as she leads the way to the top of the levee that hulks high between the houses and the Mississippi River.
I think it's just a divine place to dump a body if you should need to. I hope you never need to. What do you think? Would that be a good place?
She walks down the side of the levee to the woods, a verdant green of vines and plants.
How about if you went on the other side of those weeds? How perfect could that be? You probably should not hang out with too many crime writers. It'll really warp your sense of perspective.
Back on the other side of the river, the sun begins to set, and Julie Smith walks back through her favorite part of the city, which she never tires of, the French Quarter.
Sometimes you walk in the quarter, if you lived here as long as I am, and you look around and you think, am I really living here? Do I really get to look at this all the time? A beautiful and a really funky, broken-down kind of way. Better yet, I mean, the really best part is it's really quirky.
At the corner of St. Philip and Bourbon is her character Skip Langdon's favorite bar. Her favorite because it steps from her house and it has a hot bartender. It's called Jean Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, supposedly the oldest bar in New Orleans. It's dark, and perhaps a fitting place to talk about the most horrific secret of New Orleans. It came to light almost 3 years ago during Hurricane Katrina, that the billions of dollars spent building levees to protect the city were for naught. Julie Smith's last novel was published just a week before the storm hit the city. The night before the waters came, she had a reading at a local bookstore. She hasn't published a book since.
I've had people say to me, I always read mysteries before I go to a city because that's how I learn what's really going on there. And I feel like that's my job, is to tell what's really going on here. And until I figure out what's really going on here, I'm not sure how to write. So it has changed and is changing me, and for a while really immobilized me.
It's an epical change, she says. The city has been irrevocably shaped by a devastation on a scale that is still almost impossible to grasp 3 years later. She speaks of the thousands of houses and hundreds of lives ended, of an almost impossible road back for a city that feels abandoned and betrayed by its own government. With all that, she asks, who would want to read a book about the death of just one person, which is what a murder mystery is? When asked how Skip would have handled the storm, Smith says she would have stayed. She would have been heroic, but then she pauses.
If I really think about it, I feel she would have gone into a depression afterward. She would have seen things that were really hard to handle, and she would have become very depressed for a period of time, but she would have got past that. She would have handled it.
Julie Smith says she's handling it too. She's writing again. It took her a while, but she hopes that someday she'll begin to understand her changed city enough to have Skip Langdon once again begin uncovering its secrets. J.J. Sutherland, NPR News, New Orleans.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos.